Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Implementing a Campus Fire Safety Program. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the program, please press star, then zero on your touch-tone telephone. I would now like to introduce your host for today's program, Ms. Elisa Keehan. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the United Educators Telephone Roundtable. I'm Alyssa Keehan, a risk analyst here at United Educators, and I'll be the moderator for today's program entitled Implementing a Campus Fire Safety Program. I hope everyone received the roundtable reference materials and evaluation form. Also, I want to take a moment to point out that in the reference materials, there's an announcement about a new UE member benefit. The publication Campus Firewatch will now be available free for UE members to download from our website, and that website address is www.ue.org. You can look for new issues of Campus Firewatch the last week of every month. If for some reason you did not get the reference materials and evaluation form, please contact us at risk@ue.org. At the end of the program, we encourage you to fill out the evaluation form and fax it back to us, as your feedback is important to us. We are taping today's program, as we do all of our programs, so please be sure to check the website, www.ue.org, in the next week for the MP3 file. Our next roundtable will be in May and will address random acts of violence in public and private K-12 schools. I want to quickly remind everyone that our roundtables are not designed to provide legal advice. So without further ado, I'm very pleased to introduce our speakers for today, Ed Como and Edie Curry. Ed Como is the publisher of Campus Firewatch and the former director and founder of the Center for Campus Fire Safety. Hello, Ed, and thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity.
Also joining us is Edie Curry. She is the fire chief at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Hello, Edie, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
I want to let our listeners know that you will be able to ask questions at the end of today's program. And you can ask your questions either by email or by calling in. To pose a question via email, you can do that at any time during the program by simply emailing your questions to risk@ue.org. That email address, again, is risk@ue.org. And we will also give you instructions in about 40 minutes on how you can call in with questions for our panelists. Okay, I think we've cleared up all the housekeeping issues, so let's get on with our show. Today's program will address the three key components of a campus fire safety program. They are education, engineering, and enforcement, or the three E's. Today we will go over strategies to address each of the three E's. And Edie, if you wouldn't mind, can you tell our listeners what are some other key themes that they should be listening for as we go over the areas of education, engineering, and enforcement?
Sure, I'd love to. There are two other key themes that underlie each of the three E's, and they are combating misunderstanding and relationship building. The first one, combating misunderstanding, is an overarching theme because a lot of the fire hazards that exist on a university campus and off-campus areas as well are a direct result of misunderstanding, not just a misunderstanding by students, but by any person, including faculty, administration, or staff, who do not fully appreciate the ways in which a fire is a risk to their environment. So a lot of the strategies that we'll talk about today will have the additional function of combating the misunderstanding or educating these individuals. Also, relationship building is very important to the success of a campus fire safety program because building relationships with a lot of different groups on campus is critical to combat the misunderstanding or to educate them, and it also draws support from a worldwide number of groups and departments at the institution. Having that broad-based support is critical for implementing strategies in the areas of education, engineering, and enforcement.
Well, thanks, Edie, for explaining those two underlying themes. All right, let's start off with our first E, education. Ed, to implement a successful campus fire safety program, who on campus needs to be educated about fire safety?
Well, the answer for that one's a pretty easy one. Everyone. But that's not, that might sound like a flip answer, but you really do need to educate everybody. Now, the real challenge is doing that. It involves the students, it involves administration, it involves staff. And it involves the town as well, getting the fire department involved so everybody understands the scope of the problem and also understand what their roles are in the educational process of reaching out to the students, because I'm sure, as our listeners know, it is a challenge to reach the students, but it's also a challenge to convince administrators, faculty, staff, and the fire department, too, that they have a role in educating it and understanding all the issues that are involved in this.
So I understand it's important to educate a lot of different people on campus, but can we further break down some of the groups on campus you want to target for that education?
Sure. One of the key groups to really get involved in the very beginning is the local fire department. You know, Edie is a little bit different in that her fire department is also part of campus. That's not the case in most colleges across the country. Service is provided by a municipal fire department or a call fire department. And it's important that the fire department, first of all, be familiar with the campus. They know the layout of the campus. They know the buildings. They can do tours of these buildings on a regular basis, so they understand where all the equipment is located, how to move through the buildings, and how to get access in there. And also getting them involved in the inspections of the residence halls is fantastic, too, because not only does the fire department become familiar with the residence halls, which is great, but also it's a chance to build a relationship with the fire department, because you don't want to get to know the fire chief's name during an emergency. That's not the time. You should know this beforehand. You should know who your first two companies are and get them involved in your operations on the building so that you can get to know them. And this is also a great PR moment for the students, too, because they get to see the fire department, they get to interact with the fire department, and they realize the importance of fire safety just through this exposure and these opportunities.
Also, I agree with Ed wholeheartedly on the fire department being an important group, but another important group on campus that needs education is the administration. Since the administration is involved in managing the affairs of the university, their buy-in and support on any type of issue, but especially fire safety issues, is crucial for a successful fire safety program. You want to make sure that you educate all of your administration so that they understand the need for fire prevention. Why do we have to have it? Why it's important for the campus buildings to comply with the fire safety codes? What happens if you don't? How you can engineer your campus buildings for fire safety? There's things that you can do in the building itself that will help. And also, are they familiar with your campus fire safety policy and what it says? If they've bought into all of this, it makes it a lot easier for you to sit there and implement it campus-wide.
Edie, would you mind talking a little bit about your own experiences and some of the strategies you have used to build a relationship with those in your campus administration?
Oh, I'd love to. When I first started doing this, I attended Chancellor's Cabinet meetings so that I was able to meet with all the deans of the various departments. I attended meetings with the Provost Council where all of our researchers were, and we were able to explain to them why it was important. I attended meetings with the directors of all the administrative services units. We were even able to give a presentation to the president of the university and the Board of Regents on what was necessary in a campus fire safety program, how we were going to do it, and why it was important to have their support. We also try and involve the administration in Fire Safety Month. Here at the university, I have student firefighters, and so every October, we would have the president, the chancellor, and various other university administrators to lunch in the fire station so that they could sit there and talk to everyone. But one of the things that I think was probably more critical than anything at all is every meeting I attended and every time I interacted with members of the administration, I went in there looking at it as a two-way street. I had to learn about their concerns as well as taking the opportunity to teach them. In other words, they had certain things that they have to meet as part of their job. They have financial restrictions. There's a lot of things that they have in order to be successful, and I had to understand that in order to teach them or explain to them about how fire safety fit into that.
And the support from the administration is absolutely critical, but you know, a lot of what Edie's talking about, too, is kind of behind the scenes the students don't see. Visible support from the administration can really send a huge message to the student body about the importance of fire safety. And a great example of that is one program that we were involved with. The president was out there. They were doing a whole series of fire safety events. They were doing fire extinguisher training, burning a mock-up of a student room, just a whole bunch of things throughout the day on campus. Well, the president of the school came out there and went through the fire extinguisher training with the students. And boy, that just sent a tremendous message to all the students that were there watching the president actually take the time out of his day to come out there and participate and go through the same programs that they're doing. It gave so much credibility and validity to the program, and the students just quite literally ate it up.
Well, for MedStory, you know, it sounds like educating and building a relationship with the administration can really positively impact the education of other groups on campus. Edie, would you say this has been true for you?
Oh, most definitely. My relationship with the administration has certainly helped my ability to educate the faculty and students, which basically are the other two groups on campus that need education about fire safety. Faculty and students are the primary reason we're here.
Edie, what are some of the strategies you have used to educate the faculty?
Well, University of Alaska Fairbanks is basically a research-focused institution. We do a lot of research up here. So a lot of our faculty members are applying for research grants. This became a problem in that they were ordering equipment or they had to do certain processes in a building that really wasn't set up code-wise for it, and so then we would have a lot of fire hazards that would occur. So we would try and take advantage of the teachable moments, and when we met with the faculty that were ordering equipment or had already ordered it and were trying to install it, we would explain what the fire hazards were and the problems behind it. In order to try and prevent it, because once the equipment's there, it's really difficult, we worked with the grants office to work fire safety into the grant application. So there's actually a box they have to check now as to whether there's going to be any alteration to the facility or any new equipment is going to be introduced into the facility as part of it. That allows us to meet with the faculty ahead of time because it's flagged, and we can sit there and see if there's going to have to be any major changes to a building. A lot of people didn't realize that bringing something in that required a ventilation system on an old existing building could run upwards of $1 million to try and correct it. The other thing we did is we tried to work with them to understand the exact process and the exact research they're doing so that we could allow them to do it in a safer manner and not impact their pocketbook as much. We also place articles about fire safety in the faculty newsletter, and we try and do programs around campus anytime we can.
Well, thanks, Edie. Those are some excellent points on educating the faculty. Now let's talk about the other group you mentioned, the students. Ed, I know you've done a lot of work in the area of educating students about fire safety. Can you talk about some ideas a college or university can use to educate their students on fire safety?
Well, as I mentioned before, I'm sure everybody on this call realizes what a challenge it is to try to reach students with any kind of information, but also something about fire safety, which, you know, really isn't on their radar screen, to be honest with you. And, you know, some of the things you can use to drive home the message is the teachable moments. You know, when a fire occurs somewhere, hopefully not on your campus, but somewhere else, you can say, look, you know, this happened somewhere else. It could happen on our campus. Since January 2000, we've identified 107 fire fatalities across the country and campus-related fire fatalities across the country. Over 80% of them occur in the off-campus housing, which is your typical, you know, one- and two-family house that a number of students have gotten together to rent. And since the students are living off-campus, they're even more of a challenge to reach. So it's really critical that as soon as they step foot on your campus that you start sending them the fire safety messages and you start educating them while they're in your residence halls, because they're a somewhat captive audience. And you have that chance to impress upon them the importance of things like two ways out, smoke alarms, sprinklers, smoking fire safety, candle fire safety, halogen lamps, all that sort of thing. That, you know, I mean, for example, many schools now ban smoking. But there's no reason to not emphasize the importance of why, the reasons behind the rules, and really drill this message home to them. A big problem that has happened is, right now in the United States, we focus on two large groups when it comes to fire safety education, the very young and the very old. For most people, fire safety education stops about the third or fourth grade and doesn't start up until you're about 65. So unfortunately, many students perceive fire safety as something for little kids. If you ask them, what do they remember? They say, yeah, stop, drop, and roll, or Sparky the dog, or, you know, crawl low and smoke, all that sort of thing. So unfortunately, their perception on it is something that is for little kids, not for them. You need to change that perception and emphasize that they now have a personal responsibility for fire safety. It is within their power to control the fire safety environment that they're in and to react appropriately. But they have to know how to do these things. They have to know what to do and when to do it and how to do it. So that's where education comes into play. And a real great part of that are RAs, resident assistants. It's, you know, they have more of a role in terms of influencing student behavior when they're a freshman than I think a lot of people appreciate. But also when you're educating the RAs, it's important that they understand things like the reasons behind the rules so that they can properly communicate that to the students. A number of schools across the country are doing great things like RA Fire Academies, where the RAs are put to a day-long intense training program where they have to crawl through smoke-filled corridors. They have to learn how to do hands-on fire extinguisher training. And a lot of other things that motivate them, educate them, so that when they're interacting with the students in their charge, they can say, look, the reason you can't store a bicycle in the hallway is because it's going to become a barrier when we're trying to get out of this building, and I know, because I've been through it. They can only lead, what's the expression I'm looking for? You can only lead where you've been before. So by teaching the RAs the reasons behind the rules, it's something that they can really communicate to the other students in a real effective way.
Well, Ed, since most students live off campus, what are some creative ways for colleges and universities to reach the off-campus student population with a fire safety message?
Well, as I mentioned, it's really important to just keep it going throughout the 4 years or so that they're on campus and not just kind of wash your hands of it as soon as they move out of the residence halls. And it's great things to do some stuff like the fire academies I had mentioned. You can do those for the RAs, but you can also do those for the Greeks, where you can, the fraternities and sororities, the same type of training program with them. We've worked on programs where you build a mock-up of a student room right in the middle of campus, and actually you build two of them side by side, one sprinklered, one unsprinklered, and you fill them all with the typical student things, you know, the beds, the chairs, the desk, the books, the computers, posters on the walls, tapestry on the ceiling, and set them on fire right there in the middle of campus. Boy, you cannot come up with a more dramatic demonstration of how fast a fire can spread and how fast a sprinkler head can control that. And the nice thing about them is they're cheap and they're easy to do. They're easy to build, and you can reuse them, knock them back down again, and put them back together again. Another great thing is peer-to-peer education. I know Edie's got it up there where she's got student firefighters. They've got them at the University of Massachusetts, where I graduated from, where you've got students that you can use in reaching out to their peers, because it's a far more effective way to communicate by using peers and authority figures. Fire Safety Month. For those of you who may not know it, every September is now Campus Fire Safety Month. We started that in 2005. Last year, we had 31 governors issue proclamations designating September as Campus Fire Safety Month, and we also got a proclamation issued by the U.S. House of Representatives, and we're going for all 50 states this year in both the House and the Senate. And it's a great incentive to for you to do fire safety activities during that month. But I think the biggest thing you need to do is really be creative, is really come up with different innovative and creative ways to really get inside the heads of the students.
Well, I appreciate those thoughts on educating the off-campus population. Now I'd like to turn to our second E, engineering. Ed and Edie, what, in your opinion, are the most important fire safety engineering strategies for a college or university campus to implement?
Well, I'd say, you know, probably the out of the four, I'd say that one of the top ones is sprinkler systems, automatic fire sprinkler systems. We certainly know they save lives. It's kind of an old school sort of thing where you hear people say, well, sprinklers save buildings, fire alarms save lives. All of these things taken together are an important part of the equation, and we know that sprinkler systems will save lives. And what's happening, too, is more and more parents are becoming educated and informed and starting to ask schools, are your residence halls sprinklered, when they're looking at them with their children? And so you better have a good answer as to, you know, if they are sprinklered or if they're not, why not, or when they are going to be sprinklered. It's important to have a plan to get these things in place. Smoke alarms. Smoke alarms will pick up the fire very, very quickly. And also what's important, too, is that the smoke alarm or the smoke detectors be interconnected to the building fire alarm system so that everybody in the building is alerted to the fire very quickly, but also a signal is transmitted so the fire department can start responding immediately. There are a number of schools that will delay notifying the fire department while they investigate the alarm, which is something that is very fraught with peril, if you ask me. I think that is an extremely dangerous and risky policy to have. If the fire alarm system is going off in a building, the fire department should be rolling immediately. There are some places, too, where instead of smoke alarms, you're going to want to use a heat detector. For example, a kitchen. You don't want a smoke detector in a kitchen. You want a heat detector that will react a little bit slower than a smoke alarm, but it will still react to the fire and, again, send that signal to the fire alarm system and to the fire department. And, boy, the other thing is unobstructed exits and stairways. So often, I'm sure you see it when you're walking the halls, there are things being stored in there. It could be bicycles. Our big common problem right now is recycling bins are placed in the exit ways and the stairwells and stuff. And it creates a real problem in two respects. One, it can block egress, but also now you've put a huge fuel load into a stairwell or an exit way that some arsonist could come along and ignite. So you create several problems by having these things in the stairwells.
Well, I think you've highlighted some valuable engineering features. However, I'm sure some of our listeners may be thinking, you know, those are great ideas, but how are we going to pay for them given the tight budget at our institution? So how do you address the concern of costs when it comes to retrofitting buildings for fire safety?
Well, you know, there's no two ways about it. These things cost money, but it's part of the cost of doing business. And I think one of the things you really need to look at is your college or university big picture. You have to take a look at all the buildings you have on campus and start to prioritize, okay, which ones are at a greater risk and which ones aren't. And then also within the buildings themselves, what are the things we need to fix within these buildings to try to minimize the risk to the students? Now, probably one of the best ways you can do that is getting somebody who's really knowledgeable in that and an expertise you may not be aware of is a fire protection engineer. There are fire protection engineering firms all across this country, and that's what they do. They can come in and take a look at your total campus. They can take a look at an individual building. They can say, okay, in this particular building, this is your most immediate risk that you need to minimize. These are potential solutions you can put into place. And then they can look at your whole campus and say, okay, this is where you need to prioritize your money. Because we all know that you can't put in a sprinkler system overnight. You know, it's something that is going to take time to do it. So you can say, okay, we're going to be on a 10-year plan. These are the buildings that are at the greatest risk because we have poor egress out of them, for example. Because one of the things, for example, with a sprinkler system, by installing it, you can get trade-offs. You know, okay, by putting a sprinkler system, we can take care of this egress problem because we've reduced the risk to the people in this building. So that's something that a fire protection engineer can really help you evaluate on both the big picture and the building-by-building basis. And the other thing to keep in mind, too, is more states are passing laws requiring the mandatory retrofit installation of sprinkler systems in residence halls and other buildings. So there are two things you want to look at. One, you may be mandated to do it, but also it's going to be a marketing tool, too, where more and more parents are going to start looking for these things and saying, okay, I don't want my child to go here because you're not putting the emphasis on fire safety that you should.
Mm-hmm. I agree with Ed, and actually at the university, we just went through a large program here over the last 10 years, and while we were in the process of sprinkling the buildings at the university, we discovered that by installing sprinklers in the buildings, we actually were able to correct a lot or have an alternate method, if you will, for a lot of the code compliance issues that we had been cited on. In other words, we didn't have to correct everything because we had a sprinkler system there. Sprinklers and fire alarm systems will buy off on a lot of things in an existing building. However, when you are doing something like that, it's just critical that you have an interim plan. In other words, like Ed said, they're very expensive, they're time-consuming, and you're not going to get your whole campus sprinklered just automatically. So what you do is you have an interim plan. You have to prioritize which buildings. We use life safety. So the residence halls, of course, were number one. The other thing you need to do is while you are doing this interim plan, if you have a building that has just smoke detectors or heat detectors, it is so critical that you make sure the maintenance is up to date on those. In other words, testing is done every year. Documentation is kept. You should be conducting more inspections in these buildings. In other words, if a building normally would only need a once-a-year inspection, do it twice a year. If you have to have fire extinguishers in those buildings, make sure you have a couple extra ones in labs and various other locations. This way, if something does happen, you're showing that you are making an effort to keep those buildings as safe as possible until you can get the higher level of safety in them.
Well, I like the cost-saving retrofitting ideas you've both discussed, but what about new construction? I know a lot of colleges and university campuses are expanding, and there's a lot of new construction going on out there. So how do you make sure that new buildings are engineered for fire safety?
Well, the best thing you can do is work in a fire safety review into the planning and approval process. Here at the university, we're lucky we have deferred authority, so we do our own plan reviews. But basically what you need to do is you need to become part of the review process, even if you have another jurisdiction doing it. Someone needs to be reviewing those plans to make sure that all the life safety systems are in there. You need to be able to give feedback during construction. That means there needs to be walkthrough inspections done by somebody that's part of the university. There's a misconception out there that once the plans are approved that the building will actually be built to those plans. That, in fact, is not true. They'll try and be close, but they never will completely comply. And unfortunately, many times code violations can be generated during the construction that the university is going to be responsible for afterward. So make sure you have somebody that's actually going through doing inspections during the construction. And at the same time, identify the key relationships you need to cultivate. If you are part of a city that does your plan review, get to know the plans examiner, get to know the city inspectors. When they're out there inspecting, take the opportunity to go out there with them. You are responsible for your buildings. You are going to be stuck with the final product. Make sure it's a good one.
And something I'd like to add to that, too, is that a fire protection engineering firm can also help you pretty significantly on new construction as well as the existing buildings. I know that a number of schools in the bid process will write that in, that they will be required to have the plans reviewed or monitored by a fire protection engineer as during the construction process. I don't know. Is that something you guys do up there, Edie?
No, actually, we don't. We don't have fire protection engineers recognized in the state of Alaska.
Okay.
So, but we do the construction inspections. We have them signed off by specialty engineers.
But in a number of schools across the country, that is something they will build into the process, is having an engineer involved in that process.
It's a great idea if you don't have the technical expertise available.
Well, I appreciate those thoughts that you both shared with us on engineering. Let's turn now to our final E, enforcement. Ed, what are some of the most common enforcement problems that arise when implementing a campus fire safety program?
Well, one of the things I want to start out with when it comes to enforcement is that a lot of the problems arise just because of a lack of education. People aren't aware. And once you make them aware of the reasons behind the rules, a number of the enforcement problems will go away or be minimized, hopefully. But probably one of the bigger ones that I hear about all the time is false alarms. And really, there's actually, to be technical about it, several different categories of false alarms. There's a malicious false alarm, which is where somebody will deliberately set off the building fire alarm system knowing that there is no fire emergency in existence. And for example, the common one is somebody will go up and pull a pole station, and or somebody will blow smoke into a smoke detector hoping to set off the building fire alarm system. That's a malicious false alarm. The other one's an accidental. A smoke detector may be located too close to a kitchen or to a shower or something like that, where it senses what it thinks is a fire condition and sets off the building fire alarm system. That's an accidental alarm. And it's really important to communicate to the students when these things happen what is going on so they understand, because otherwise you get a cry wolf syndrome. It's just like, oh, it's another false alarm. And it's also important that the school identify the root cause of the alarms so they can correct them. Because the biggest problem, again, is that cry wolf syndrome. January 2000, three students were killed at a fire at Seton Hall University in New Jersey. In the weeks leading up to that fatal fire, there had been 19 false alarms in that building. When that fire broke out, hours later, when the fire department was doing another sweep through the building, they still found students sleeping in their rooms because they didn't evacuate because they thought it was just another false alarm. Okay, so it's really important to properly investigate all these alarms, determine the cause, and communicate to the students what's happening. Smoking rooms is another problem. Many of the schools have banned smoking, which is good from a health and a safety standpoint, but also bad from it kind of has driven the students underground, and they're trying to conceal the smoking that they're doing. So they'll take steps. For example, they may tape over a smoke detector with plastic and duct tape so it won't go off. They had one fire at a campus where the student rolled up a towel and put it at the crack underneath the door and then stuck incense in the door and lit it to try to mask the smell of the smoke. Well, that incense stick fell down, ignited the towel on fire, and started a fire. So they are creative when it comes to trying to conceal those sort of things. Cooking in rooms, many schools have banned cooking and also provide central areas for them to do it in. But, you know, you'll get the portable grills going and things like that, or where students are trying to cook in their rooms. And you know, all the attendant problems that go along with that. It's also important to explain to students why you don't allow some items in your residence halls, for example, halogen lamps. And that's not as much of a problem as it used to be. I'm talking about the floor light, floor-mounted kind of lamps where students used to have those come in and they would tip over, something would fall and they would ignite. That's not as much of a problem as you see anymore, but also just, you know, okay, why you can't have a candle. Why you can't bring in your own furnishings because, you know, it doesn't meet a flammability standard that the school may have. It's just really important that they understand the reasons behind these rules, that, yes, these things have started fires that have killed people. That's really what it comes down to. And as I mentioned, the other one is tampering with smoke detectors and trying to take them out of service so they can smoke in their rooms and stuff. That what they have to understand is that, sure, it may be for your own benefit immediately that you're doing this, but what you're doing is you're placing the entire building at risk by being selfish. You want to smoke in your room, you disable a smoke alarm, but you have placed potentially the thousands of other people in that building at risk by doing that.
Well, Ed, you've mentioned some important enforcement issues. Have either of you identified some good strategies for dealing with these fire safety enforcement problems?
Here at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, we've been fairly successful. And again, it all comes back to relationship building. We're very fortunate. We have an excellent residence life program, the dean of students, our judicial officer. We've worked with all of them over the years and really developed and cultivated a great relationship. Having the authority here from the State Fire Marshal's Office, as well as just the authority that's given to you, empowered, if you will, by the relationships we have with them, we've made some great strides in enforcement. For example, years ago when we first started this, we had 600 false alarms a year in the buildings, and we've been able to reduce them to last year we had one malicious and 49 accidental, and most of the accidental ones were construction. During construction, someone sanding or doing something, not realizing there's a duct detector, and they set it off. And basically, part of the way we did that was, number one, we went through all of the alarm systems, and we tried to fix any maintenance problems. Like Ed said, when there's safety or when there's automatic fire alarms going off constantly and there's no reason for it, they get very blasé and they will not leave their rooms. So we wanted to make sure that if an alarm did go off, it was a valid alarm. So we did a lot of maintenance. We replaced and upgraded a lot of systems. But the malicious ones, we still were running close to 100 of just malicious ones. And like I say, being down to one now is great success. And what we did is we implemented a fine. And we do this through residence life. We bill them $250 for a false alarm, and in some cases upwards of $1,000. Depending on the seriousness of it and the attitude of the student, we will also file criminal charges with the local court system. So it didn't take too many times of doing that, and they finally understand that false alarms will not be tolerated, nor will malicious ones. But however, we also tell the students that if they accidentally trigger alarm because they leaned against the pull station or they did something, they just need to wait there for the fire department, explain to us what happened, and, you know, accidents do happen, and we will try and work with them on that. In addition to the false alarms, though, another enforcement problem we had at the university was special events. Fire codes weren't necessarily being followed at these events. And again, it wasn't deliberate or malicious. They truly did not understand. This kind of came out, if you will, when I received a phone call at home at 10 to 7 one Saturday night to tell me that they wanted to deactivate all the smoke detectors in the Patty Gym, that they were having a rock concert. And they had 2,500 people there already, and they wanted to use smoke machines. That was the first the fire department had heard of anything going on there. So needless to say, we did not approve it, but it made us realize that there were special events taking place on campus that we didn't know about. So what we did is we got together with all the other departments that really had a need to know, like residence life, like facility services, the police department, dining and catering, and all the different departments that could be involved in a special event. And we had a form put on the website. So anybody who wants a special event pulls up this form, fills it out, and it gets distributed by email to all these different departments. Each one of us read it, and then we send back comments to the party as to what we would need, if there's any problems, or if we have no objections. But this way we know exactly what's going on the campus, and it sure has prevented a lot of problems.
Well, before I ask a final question of our speakers, I'd like to go ahead and announce that we're opening the phone lines for participant questions. It's very easy to ask a question. All you need to do is press the 1 on your touch-tone phone, and you'll be placed in line to ask a question to one of our speakers. If you decide for any reason that you don't want to ask your question, just simply press the pound key, and that will take you out of the queue. If asking a question by phone, please remember to turn off the listen-only or mute feature on your phone, since we want to be sure to hear your question when it's your turn. And remember, if you prefer, you can also submit questions via email. Just send your questions to risk@ue.org. All right, getting back to our program, Ed, what types of flammable items do you recommend institutions prohibit in their residence halls, and are there any new trends you're seeing in the way of prohibited items?
Well, one of the new trends that's coming up, and as a matter of fact, the school just asked this question the other day, as you're well aware, there's a new standard coming out of California that's coming across the country, and that's a flammability standard for mattresses. More and more schools are adopting this standard, and the idea is to minimize the fuel load in any room so that if a fire does break out, there's less fuel for the fire to use, and then therefore the fire will be less. So that's being used across the country more and more, and schools might want to become more aware of that. But also what schools are doing is using this same standard for other furnishings in the room. For example, I know at the University of Massachusetts here, for example, they use the same standard when students want to bring their own private furnishings. For example, somebody wants to bring a beanbag chair into their dorm room or an overstuffed chair. And the school will say, sure, you can do that if you can prove that it meets the California standard for flammability. And oftentimes they can't, or it just doesn't have that kind of information. So that's how they're able to restrict what students will bring into the room, so they don't have to come up with a policy of, no, you can't bring any furnishings whatsoever. Because it is their home, and they want them to feel comfortable there, but also they have to do it to a point where they don't, you know, make it onerous. So that's something that, you know, you might want to keep in mind when it comes to looking at items like that. Certainly banning the things like, you know, anything that's involved with cooking, you know, not to use a brand name, but, you know, the George Foreman type grills, those little grills that can be brought in, and those can certainly create a problem. They had one at a university down in Washington, D.C., where it was a residence hall with 1,000 people in it, ninth floor, a student came home, threw some food on, fell asleep, grill continued to cook until it ignited his bedding on fire. And unfortunately, in that building, there was no smoke detectors in the room, and it was spotted by a passing Secret Service patrol 9 stories down at the street level. So that fire really got out of control from just a simple cooking, which was banned, but he did it anyways. And I think now he certainly understands the reasons behind the rules when it comes to things like that. There are some other things, too, and I think Edie's involved. They do this up at your school. The fire retardant paper, isn't that something you folks use up there?
Yes, we do. If we've got real tight control over corridors, we believe that the exit system should be kept as unobstructed and clear as anything that could burn as possible. And so what we do, if there's any posters or any paperwork that goes into the hallways, all the paper has to be fire retardant. There are sprays that you can find that you spray it. It's fairly expensive, but if they want their posters and stuff up, that's one of the things they do have to comply with.
And also other things like, for example, the tapestries. You know, a lot of people want to hang tapestries from their ceilings. Those mock-ups that I mentioned that we build in the middle of campus and set on fire, we hang the tapestries from the ceiling in those, and, boy, that makes for one dramatic fire once that thing gets going. It's just Katie bar the door because the fire just spreads so tremendously. But also keep in mind that now we're talking about residence halls, but these same things apply for when the students are living in Greek housing or they're living off campus. So if you have that opportunity to send that message to them in the residence halls that this is a problem and why it's a problem, it's, you know, hopefully that message will stick. And especially if you keep reinforcing it throughout the 4 years. Don't stop when they move out of your residence halls. Come up with programs where this same kind of information is always is always given to them throughout their college career. It's just incredibly important. One thing I want to bring up, too, if we have time here, Alyssa, is about the five-way light.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Go ahead.
This came up several months ago. A school in New York posted something on their website about and it's kind of hard to describe, but visualize it's a floor lamp, and it comes up, and it spreads out into five independent lamps, each one a different color, and with a light bulb in it. What they were finding was, and these are very inexpensive, they're about $20. You get them at the major retailers like Walmart, Target, that, you know, those sort of places. And what was happening is they were finding a number of these where students were putting the wrong wattage bulb in there, and it was causing the colored lampshade to melt. And then that, you know, if there's something in close proximity to that, like a poster or something like that, it was causing a singe on that. We haven't been able to find any actual fires that broke out, but certainly these things were not being used properly. I brought it to the attention of Underwriters Laboratories. They conducted an investigation on it, and they did determine that certain models were equipped with counterfeit UL labels on them. So they'd come out of China. They'd had counterfeit UL labels put on them. So they did issue a notice on their website. It's on our website. You go to www.campus-firewatch.com, or you can go to ul.com, and you can find out information about specifically what model was banned. But the problem that's arising, too, is that schools are doing a blanket ban on all of these lamps, and there are different manufacturers and there are different models out there. And unfortunately, there's no real detailed information that has been given out as to what is exactly the problematic manufacturer and model being used in this. So it's something to be cognizant of. It is a problem. And the real problem seems to be that they call for a 25-watt lamp, but students very easily and unknowingly putting 60-watt lamps in there, which causes it to overheat and melt those down. So it's just something to be aware of, that more and more schools are taking action on this.
Well, Ed and Edie, I want to thank you for sharing your valuable thoughts and experiences on the three E's of the Campus Fire Safety Program. We've got some folks in the queue here, so I want to briefly remind everyone just to please take a look at those reference materials for this roundtable, as there's a pretty thorough catalog of current resources on campus fire safety, and the resources really nicely supplement the topics that we've covered here today, particularly, you know, Ed was talking about the effectiveness as a learning tool of burning mock-ups of student rooms. And there is a video that United Educators produced with Middlebury College that actually demonstrates one of those burns of a student rooms, and you can find that on page 7 of the reference materials. And also on page 5, there is a guide for building those mock-ups. So if you're curious on how to go about building one of those student mock-ups for a burn, check out page 5, because campusfirewatch.com has detailed explanations on how to do that as well. Okay, operator, I think we're ready for our first telephone question.
Okay, great. Our first question comes from Thompson Baker Agency. Your question, please.
Yes, my name is Ken Russom. I'm the Vice President of Business Services. I have with me my security chief and dean of students. In various times, we were looking at our plan and reviewing our plan, and about a year or so ago, we tried to come up with an assignment of responsibility to each professor or anyone in a classroom to take charge and somewhat lead the student out of the classroom. And the professors balked at this because they felt that they were taking on a liability which was not theirs to have. And my question is, has anyone experienced this? Was this unreasonable, and or has this worked before at other institutions? End of question.
Edie, do you have anything on that? Because I'm not really...
Yeah, basically what we've tried to do is a similar type thing. In other words, it's called an accountability system. And, you know, in grade school, high school, they have it where they take the classroom out, they have their list, they go down the checklist, and they tell you who's there or not. One of the problems we've run into is very similar to the gentleman calling, only that because the students aren't tracked as well as they are, in other words, you don't know if a student decided not to come in today. They don't really take attendance in all classes the way they do in grade school. So we've not been able to find a real good way of doing it. We try to get the people to sit there, the professor, just to tell us if they have anyone missing. What we do is we have the professor or whoever's in charge of the classes meet with the fire chief or whoever the fire officer is to say that, I think I have everybody out. We don't have any accountability if they didn't make it to class, but we do have an accountability if they got out of the building or out of the room.
And I have to agree with that. I think it's a real problem in terms of making them responsible for doing a headcount. But I think where it really comes into play, too, and I haven't talked to anybody that has a good solution on this, is when it comes to disabled students.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a student in a wheelchair or you have a student on crutches or some other disability, you know, how do you handle that situation? And that's something that's critically important to communicate to the fire chiefs, that, yes, everybody got out except I have this one person up there, or they're in an area of refuge or something like that.
That's actually where our question came from, where my question started when we were doing this for disabled students. But we wound up with the solution of putting a collecting station, I guess you would say that, on the landings outside of the fire doors. That was our solution to it, good or bad. That's what we have in place now.
And that is an acceptable one. The code says that there should be an area of refuge, and usually it's on the landing. And, of course, most fire departments are going to use the stairwell, so they are going to rescue those people. But we also, in addition to doing that, we have a student assigned to stay with that physically challenged student so that they're not there alone.
Well, that was a problem for us. That went back to accountability, liability. A student would do that probably on their own, but to assign the student, that was where the professors balked at it. They didn't want to do that. To assign a student, call for volunteers, interesting problem, but I just have a good feeling that some student would assist. The other side of the coin was that a lot of the stable students said, don't worry about us. We can get out and we can get to the landing, but that's maybe just unique to our institution. We don't have that many wheelchair-bound students.
And I think that would be a big risk to take, to be honest with you. I mean, I agree with you that a lot of people altruistically probably would assist in that sort of situation, but I think the biggest thing is to communicate that to the fire department that, you know, there is this person up there or this situation exists. I think that's vitally important to communicate that information.
Well, that's how we handle it. My security chief is here, and we have a location every hour of class time as to where a disabled, severely disabled, wheelchair-bound student would be. That's how we set it up. Hopefully it's never tested.
Well, operator, I think we're ready for our next call.
Certainly. Our next question comes from Hofstra University. Your question, please.
Hi, I'm Linda O'Malley, the Associate Dean of Students. And we are working as a university pretty successfully in educating our new first-year and transfer students during our Welcome Week process. But New York State has some pretty strict guidelines as to who needs to be educated. So we are trying to move towards a computerized educational refresher system for all continuing students. Do you know of any other schools who have been able to do that successfully?
This is Edie. I'm not, because we're trying to develop the exact same thing.
And there are a number of schools, I hear the same sort of thing, that yes, they would like to do it. It's something that I dabbled in a few years ago, coming up with something, because really what I wanted to do was get the students to do that, because who better to develop something that would appeal to students than the students themselves. And we're actually in the process right now of conducting a series of focus groups with colleges and university students to try to determine how they most effectively get their information. Because, you know, putting a brochure on their pillow when they move into the dorm isn't the way to do it, but something that they can download to their iPod might be. But it has to be in a way that they would find appealing, engaging, and entertaining and all that sort of stuff. And actually, we're looking for locations to do some of these focus groups, so if anybody out there would like to talk to me about that, you know, please drop me a note, and I'd like to talk to you about that, because we want to develop those kind of programs that, yes, students would find interesting and engaging, and would meet the New York program. And I'm glad you mentioned that, because New York, in my mind, probably has the leading program in this country when it comes to campus fire safety education and inspection. And they have seen the statistical results of that, too, where the violations have dropped, the problems have dropped, the fire incidents certainly have dropped. I mean, I'm sure it's a burden to you, but also at the same time, my hat is really off to the New York State Fire Marshal's Office for what they've done out there.
Thank you.
Ed and Edie, we've got an email question from the White Mountain School. They want to know, how do we keep students from misusing fire extinguishers? Edie, any thoughts?
Basically, what I do is if I have a fully sprinkler building, I take them out. It's unfortunate, but in 10 years, every discharge of a fire extinguisher that I had on this campus was students playing with them. There was never one documented case of it being used on an actual fire. So we chose to use smoke detectors and sprinklers, kind of our robot firemen, until we get there, and we removed all fire extinguishers except for labs, shops, and areas that are non-sprinklered. And then the other thing we do is we try and monitor them. And like I say, we have a $250 fine for discharging it.
Operator, we'll take our next question.
Could I add a little bit to that first?
Sure.
Okay. One thing, too, I mean, a number of schools have done that, removed them. But there's another thing, too, that, and I'm not shilling for this company at all, but they've got a great product out there that supervises the fire extinguisher, mm-hmm. so that if it's taken off the wall, it trips a signal into the fire alarm. So it doesn't trip the building fire alarm system, it sends a signal to it. And it also monitors it in terms of make sure it's pressure, the pressure is maintained and all that stuff, so it cuts down on your inspection cycle in there. I think it's a pretty neat product, so that if you do make the decision that you can't take out fire extinguishers and you're having a maintenance problem or a discharge problem, it's something that you know it's worthwhile looking into. Sorry, go ahead, Alyssa.
That's okay. We're ready for our next call.
All right, our next question comes from Concordia University, Chicago.
Hello, Jason Hoyt, I'm here. I'm wondering, and you just mentioned it again, this fine for people tampering with the smoke detector or setting off fire alarms, tampering with the extinguishers. Is that a fine for the individual? And if so, how do you identify that individual? Because that's been our biggest problem. Or is it just a fine across the board for whatever building that it occurs in?
Well, when we first started doing it, our problems really were in the residence halls. So we fined the actual residence life. And my understanding was that the students had always chipped in at the beginning of the semester for kind of a party fund, and the money would come out of that unless we could identify the individual. Well, the first year, nobody wanted to, you know, narc on their buddies or anything. But once the other students found out that they had to pay for it, and if there was no money available, the fine would be prorated among all the occupants of the building. So you could not register for class, you could not get your grades, you couldn't do anything until your share of it was paid. Once that started happening about the second year, I would barely make it back to my office, and I would have the person's name and phone number on my phone, because if we can identify the person, then that person themselves is fined, not the residence life.
Thank you very much.
All right, I think we're ready for our next call.
Certainly. Our next question comes from Marymount University. Your question, please.
I apologize. We'd had our question answered, and so we tried to cancel.
That's fine. We'll move on to the next call.
Our next question comes from Colorado Mountain College.
Hello, my name is Mark Aliegos. I'm enjoying this tremendously. I have two questions. Which code requires doors with closures be kept closed? And also, are sprinklers required on all floors if only currently in a basement?
Boy, that would depend on which code you've adopted and the year of the code. Without knowing exactly when yours were built, there's the international codes right now, but there used to be the NFPA has a building code. There was a Southern building code, there was BOCA, and there were the uniform codes. And it really depended on the use or classification of that building as to whether some cases it was only the basement that had to be sprinklered, and then in other cases, depending on the use of the building, it had to be the other floors. And as far as closing them, the one I deal with is the International Fire Code, or it used to be the Uniform Fire Code, that says you have to maintain the one-hour corridor.
And again, that's one of those fire protection engineering can really help you a lot, a fire protection engineering firm or fire protection engineer, because it does vary so much depending on what code you have and the building layout and a lot of other variables.
Ed, I have a question. How would an institution find a fire protection engineering firm?
Well, Google is a wonderful thing if you put it in there, but also an organization you can go to is the Society of Fire Protection Engineers, and their website is sfpe.org. Again, that's sfpe.org, and they can assist you in finding one in your area, and I'll be glad to help identify some, too.
All right, I think we're ready for our next call.
Our next question comes from Gallaudet University. Your question, please.
Hi, we have actually two questions.
We are interested in the microwave wattage that is appropriate in a dorm room and the number and type of appliances that you can plug into the wall, the electrical source. The second question is, how do you enforce it? Do you have any words of advice for us doing room inspections and actually helping with the enforcement of prohibited items, microwaves, strips, candles, everything?
When we do walkthroughs, we take it. They're going to have to buy it again if they want to try and put it back. And if we have serious violations after they've been told, our residence life will ban them from the dorms. They will have to move off campus. Up here in Alaska, because of our winters and stuff like that, we take fire safety extremely, extremely serious. We can't afford to have anything closed down. As far as how many things can be plugged in the wall, most of your breakers are going to be a 15 or a 20-amp breaker, and you're going to have to just check the amperage of everything. We have a list of acceptable appliances, and I want to say our microwaves are 600-watt, but I'm not 100% sure. I'd have to look it up. But we have a list that says what size and how many they can have in there. If anything is found during an inspection, we take it, and they just lose it.
What a number of schools will do, too. I mean, for example, you brought up what's the proper wattage on a microwave. And they'll provide these things. And there's, and again, I'm going to throw these brand names out there, but I'm not shilling for these guys at all. It's another thing called microfridge, which is a combination microwave and dorm fridge that the school says this, either A, we provide it, or B, this is the only allowable appliance in this room. So if you want to rent it, here's the vendor you get it from and all that stuff. By doing so, they're controlling what kind of appliance is brought in and what wattage and such. Also, other schools have done that, too, for example, for power strips. You know, you can only use this kind of acceptable power strip, and maybe it's available to the school store, or maybe they've made an arrangement with a vendor or something like that. In other words, they're dictating what types of appliances can be brought in. And like Edie said, it really matters on, or it really depends on what kind of electrical capability you have in your building as to how much they can plug in and keep going in there.
All right. I think we're ready for the next call.
Our next question comes from Our Lady of the Lake University.
Test one.
It's ready.
It's ready.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Great. Yeah, this is Joe Becker at Our Lady of the Lake University. We're in the process of upgrading some of our fire alarm systems in the different buildings, and we're talking to contractors that are a little confused by all the new codes, the NFPA and the International Fire Codes, as to whether or not you can have standalone fire alarms in the dorm, student dorm rooms, or do they have to be connected to the building fire alarm panel?
Boy, I'm not sure if that's a local call or not. I know the state of Alaska has specific requirements. Ours in the actual high-rise dorms and stuff cannot be standalone. They have to be tied in to be able to alert. But yet when we have apartments on campus that are single-family apartments, those can be standalone. So a lot of it depends on what size your dorm is and which regulations your state has adopted.
And part of that, too, is in what they've done, and again, it's a code issue, but also it could be the sort of thing that instead of if a smoke detector goes off in an individual room, it may not dump the whole building, may not activate the building fire alarms, but it will send a signal to the fire alarm panel, which in turn will send a signal to a monitor location so somebody can go and investigate it and determine what's going on. I'm not an advocate of a standalone smoke alarm in a room. I think it should be supervised in some way, shape, or form. And there are different variables or different ways you can do that. Again, keep coming back to that fire protection engineer. That's the person who can really help you on stuff like that.
All right. Well, we're going to take two more phone calls before we wrap up here. So, operator, let's take the next call.
Certainly. Our next question comes from Wake Forest University.
Yes, my name is Scott Frazier, and I wanted to see in a residence hall where you have a very small corridor, four rooms off the corridor, and you got photo detectors with audible signals in each bedroom, and out in the hallway you have a photo detector. Is it best to change out the detectors in the hallway to ionization if you're getting false alarms from shower steam. Is that the best application when you have a ventilation problem?
We run into the same problem up here, and we've had to move detectors to a different location, but we have also done the exact same thing you have. We've swapped photoelectrics and ionizations back and forth until we get the right coverage, because as we discussed earlier, false alarms are just going to kill you on that one. So either move it to a different location in that hallway where it's not going to be affected by the shower, or switch it out.
Thank you.
All right, we'll take our last call.
Our final question comes from Hampton-Sydney College.
Good afternoon. This is Chuck Ironmonger speaking, and I just wanted to ask what the recommendation would be for dorm room inspections. How many per year?
We inspect, we have the RAs. We kind of use them as an arm to do it at least once a semester. We try and hit them once before the start of each semester. So we would hit them, in January before the spring semester, in the summer because we have summer programs, and then again before the fall semester. And we don't necessarily hit every single dorm room. We just go through, we check the test records to make sure all the detectors have been done. But during the school year when the rooms are actually occupied, we recommend that the RAs go through them at least once. If you have a problem student that seems to be violating, then I would probably do theirs once a month.
Okay, but there are no room inspections by school administration personnel or staff?
No, we do the common areas. We do the hallways, we do the lounges, the kitchens, you know, conference rooms, any place where you would actually have the students come together, but we don't do their individual ones.
Ed, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, a number of schools that I know of will do them during winter break, for example. That's when the fire inspectors, it will be staff, will go through the rooms to make sure that everything is up to speed. And what they find amazing, too, is that, you know, the students know it. They know that it's going to happen, yet they're continually amazed at the things that they still find in there. Even though they know they're going to do the sweep and go through the rooms. Things certainly, I know at UMass, for example, the things have gotten better remarkably over the years with students finding less violations. But I think at least once a year, if not twice a year, is a good time to do it. And your RAs are also another tool in that first line of defense. But I think, you know, the staff definitely does need to go through there at least once a year just to make sure that everything is up to speed.
Thank you both.
Well, we're going to wrap up the roundtable now, and I want to thank everyone for participating today. And if for some reason we did not get to your question, you can go ahead and email that question to risk@ue.org, and we'll try to respond. Special thanks to our panelists, and we hope that you found today's program informative and that you will check UE's website for further information on our next roundtable in May. Please don't forget to fill out the evaluation form and fax it back to us, because we really do value your feedback. And this concludes today's roundtable. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for your participation in today's conference. This does conclude the program. You may now disconnect. Good day.